All right, tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off in the book of Exodus. We left off in chapter 4. That's Exodus chapter 4. And if you remember, just a brief background as far as the conclusion of chapter 3 we went through last week, that God had appeared to Moses in a burning bush, and he told him that he was going to commission him to go to Pharaoh, to Egypt, and to be his spokesman to let God's people go. And Moses obviously had a very... Well, a lot of reluctance to want to do this, okay, for a number of reasons that we'll get into. But, you know, God said that he chose him to be his spokesman. And I think that there's a lot to be learned when we look at Moses' reaction in chapter 4 and 5 and 6 in regards to, you know, when God tells us to do something, I think that he really is looking for an obedient heart, but he's also looking for a heart that recognizes our own inadequacies. And recognizing that, hey, we are totally and utterly dependent upon him. Now, remember, 40 years before God appeared to him, you know, Moses was in Egypt. And I think that Moses had a sense that maybe he could do something for his people. And as a matter of fact, I do believe that he really desired to free his people. And he thought perhaps that he was in a position to do so because politically he was theoretically in line for the throne if something were to happen, you know, to, let's say, Pharaoh's son or something like of that nature, that he could be in a position where he could be their savior. Well, he acted rashly. He acted in the flesh. He acted impulsively. And after killing an Egyptian, then he found himself on the run. And he had to run for his life. He went way down to Midian. I don't have that map up there. But anyway, he runs away from Pharaoh, from Egypt. And so he spends 40 years in the desert. And now God appears to him in this burning bush, and the story picks up in this chapter 4 where it says, "Then Moses answered and said, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you." And he's talking about the elders of Israel, you know, that God is going to send them to. And he feels like, okay, well, what if they don't believe me? Now, if you look at Moses, I think that if I counted right, there's at least five successive excuses that Moses begins to make. Feeling like, well, gee, man, I'm not the one that you send. I really shouldn't send me, send somebody else. I mean, he comes up saying, well, maybe they won't believe me, and then I'm really not a very eloquent speaker, and this and that. He's coming up with a bunch of excuses because in his heart, he's thinking, man, I just don't want to do this. Okay? And I think that there's something to be said for that because I think the people who make sometimes the best leaders are the people who really do not want to be in that position. You know, people who very often in our political realm who make the worst leaders are the ones who will do anything to get elected and to get reelected. And they will say anything and they will do anything. It's so all important to them. Well, they make the most terrible leaders. You know, all we have to do is just look at the White House and see a classic example. You just long for a person who could get up there and say, listen, you know, my principles mean more to me than getting elected. And if it means that I lose this job, then I'll lose this job. If it means that you don't vote for me, then don't vote for me. But I'm going to take a stand on this, and this is why my principles lie. And I'm not going to be doing a tap dance, you know, back and forth to try to please everyone and be all things to all men and put my finger in the wind, you know, to see which way the public opinion is blowing, simply because this position is so all important to me that I, you know, I will do anything and say anything to be elected or to be in a position of power. Well, we see what we get when we have people who will do anything to be in that position of leadership. Well, I think the most effective leaders are the ones who are most reluctant to lead. They're kind of pushed into the situation through circumstances or through divinely orchestrated situations where they find themselves in that position. And I think that they really are effective because they feel like, hey, if I'm gone tomorrow, hey, fine with me. Okay, but if I'm in the job, I'm going to do the best I can. Okay, anyway, in verse 1 it says, "Then Moses answered and said, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I have to say, for that they may say the Lord has not appeared to you?" Now, that's a legitimate, you know, concern. Okay, God's calling to just a monumental task, and he's going, man, you know, what if these people don't even believe what I'm going to say? So this is what God says in return. And the Lord said to him, "What is in your hand?" And he said, "A staff." And he said, "Throw it to the ground." So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail." So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. And the Lord furthermore said to him, "Now put your hand into your bosom." So he put his hand into his bosom, and then he took it out, and behold, his hand was leprous like snow. And he said, "Put your hand into your bosom again." So he put his hand into his bosom, and again Again, and when he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. And it shall come about that if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, then they may believe the witness of the last sign. But it shall be that if they will not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. Okay, before we go any further, Moses has a legitimate concern, wondering, well, what if these people aren't going to believe me, and you know, what's going to happen to me, and so on and so forth. So God just says, okay, so what's in your hand? He says, well, it's a staff. You know, it was just a shepherd's staff. He said, throw it to the ground. He throws it to the ground, and it becomes a serpent. All right, and Moses, you know, got pretty terrified by it. He started to run away from it, but God gives him a command, says, grab it by the tail. And I think anybody who has any common sense would know you just don't grab a snake by the tail. I mean, he had really had to step out in faith by this. I think there's a couple things to keep in mind. First of all, the staff that he had in his hand, it was just a shepherd's staff. But if you read in other portions of Scripture, it really became the symbol of authority. You know, he was going up against Pharaoh, and Pharaoh was, let's face it, the most powerful man in the world. I mean, you know, if he said, off goes your head, and then off goes your head. I mean, there was nobody that could oppose Pharaoh, basically. Okay? And Pharaoh ruled with a scepter, so to speak. Okay, that was his sign of authority. That was his sign of sovereignty, of power. And then Moses has a shepherd staff. And God is going to show him, well, this is going to be the sign of your power, your authority. So he throws it to the ground. It becomes a serpent. And I think that's kind of significant because, you know, even in Egypt, the picture of the serpent often symbolized power, authority, dominance. For example, you know, very often the Pharaoh's headdress, they would have a picture of a cobra right upon their headdress. Well, it was almost as though God was going to meet them head on with his power. Okay, put yourself in Moses' shoes. Okay, it becomes a serpent. He's really afraid of it, but God tells him, grasp it. Don't just touch it. He says, here, pick it up. He says, grab it. Grasp it. But I mean, that took an act of faith, didn't it? I mean, I'm sure he just was really reluctant to do it, but he did it anyway. And I think sometimes that, you know, when God tells us to do something, you know, as repulsive as it may be, I mean, if we are just obedient, God is going to work things through for his glory, for his honor, for our well-being, and just like we did with Moses here, okay, demonstrating his power. So it became a staff in his hand again. And then he says this. Now God says, that'll be the first sign. If you show them that, okay, if they don't believe that, then he says, okay, now put your hand in your bosom. Now, I looked up the word bosom in the dictionary, and it talks about this breast area. This is your breast. It's not your stomach. It's your breast. He was told to put his hand inside his cloak, okay, into his bosom. Okay, and he takes his hand out, and it's snow white. It's leprous. It's a skin disease. And in the Bible, there's all kinds of skin ailments that refer to as leprosy. Okay, and some of them are absolutely incurable, and some of them were considered to be contagious. Okay, but obviously, you know, anybody with leprosy at that particular time, they were ostracized. But what's interesting is that when he pulled it out, it was leprous. And I'm sure that he was pretty shocked to see that. And thinking, my gosh, what's happened to him? And then God said, well, put it back in. He puts it back in and then takes it back out. What the spiritual symbolism of that is, I really believe, if you look deep within the Scriptures and deep within the heart of man, you can see it. Because the Bible talks about how the heart is deceitful above all things, it's desperately wicked, but nobody can know it but the Lord. And Jesus himself said that from the heart comes forth all of man's wickedness. He says from the heart comes forth adulteries and fornications and blasphemies and thefts, and all of the different things come from the heart. Okay? If you really know your heart, you know that your heart is evil. You know, most people today with this humanist philosophy are always trying to convince us that, hey, man is basically good, that we are born basically good, you know, and all we do need to do is be nurtured with the right, you know, environment, with the right upbringing, with the right education, with the right social and economic advantages, and so on and so forth, and then man is going to achieve some kind of state of not just respectability, but perfection. Well, we all know that is a crock. If you just look at history, if you look at the world today, anybody with any common sense would have to look at the Bible and say, yes, the Bible says that man is basically evil. So what I'm saying is this. It says in Proverbs that we are to watch over our heart with all diligence, because from our heart flows forth the issues of life, the springs of life. From the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. I mean, this is where it is. This is the seat of our fallen nature. Moses puts his hand in, takes it out. It's almost as though before God can really use a man to to any degree, he's got to see himself for what he is. He's got to take a good, hard, cold look at his heart and say, hey, just like Paul said, in me dwelleth no good thing. Anyone who looks at themselves and say, hey, I'm basically a good person, they cannot really be used of God to any extent whatsoever, because they haven't seen themselves like Paul seen himself, like Isaiah saw himself. When he saw God lifted up in a vision, Isaiah says, woe is me, for I am undone, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. I mean, when we see God, well, I'm not talking about with your physical eyes, I'm talking about in your spiritual eyes, when you can see God, you know, and get a glimpse of his holiness and his goodness and his righteousness, man, you get an overwhelming sense of your own sinfulness. But we're living in a day and age where the overwhelming majority of people in this country especially get this idea that, well, I'm basically good. You know, if men could just see how wretched they are, I think it would make a tremendous difference in terms of them doing something about it. I mean, the sickest people in the world are the people who are terminally ill, but they think they're well. Well, spiritually speaking, that's what's happened to this country and to most of the people in this country. If a man can look at himself and say, hey, in me dwelleth no good thing. I am a sinner. I am a wretch. I am on my way to hell. And that is in no way, shape, or form, you know, expressing any low self-esteem whatsoever. It's just taking a good, hard, cold, naked look at what you are and saying, hey, man, I'm a sinner. I am lost, and I'm on my way to hell, and I need a Savior. When Moses took out his hand, it was almost as though he could see what's in his heart. That leprosy always represented sin in the Bible. And he could see that in my heart is nothing but sin. But now that he sees it, recognizes it, now God's going to change it. He's not just going to patch it up. It's going to be a new heart. Because when he puts it back in and he takes it out, it's clean. It's totally whole again. And that's what God has to do with all of us. He can't just simply patch up the old man. It's got to be a new creation, a complete transformation. You know, that's what's got to be changed within our heart. So when Moses took out his hand and it was cleansed, it was like there was more to it than just simply a miracle. There was a spiritual reality behind it. Then he says here, okay, verse 8, he says, and it shall come about that if they will not believe or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of the last sign. And that last sign, of course, was the hand. He says, but it shall be that if they do not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. Now, here's another interesting thing. Okay, now, God doesn't demonstrate this to Moses. He just simply tells him now. Okay, now listen, if the elders don't believe the sign of the staff becoming a serpent and then coming a staff again, if they don't believe the sign of the hand becoming leprous and then becoming whole again, then take some water from Nile, pour it on the ground, and it will become blood. It's just pouring out. And that will be a sign. Well, God was actually pointing to what was going to be the first plague that was going to be brought against Pharaoh. Now, I think this is very significant because when we get into reading that, I'll get into that a little deeper, but we know that that was the first judgment or plague that was brought against Egypt, okay, when he turned the river Nile into blood. Now, that was an awesome display of God's power. The whole river becomes blood, all the fish in the Nile die, and how long did it remain blood? Anybody remember? It remained blood for 7 days. So the people, you know, out of desperation, began digging wells around the Nile to get some fresh water, water that was potable, water that they could be able to drink so they could survive. But I think it's very significant that God turned the Nile into blood. Anybody have any idea what's the poetic justice in that? Well, if you remember that when Moses was a baby, the Pharaoh said, look, you know, this is going to be what we're going to do to get rid of the population of the Israelites. We're going to have all the newborn males thrown where? Into the Nile. It became a place of death for the Israelite people. Okay, the boys. Remember in the book of Revelation, when we went through that, in the very end of the world, the very end, towards the end of the tribulation, the whole ocean turns to blood, the blood of a dead man. Every living creature dies in the ocean. But not only that, all the fresh water turns to blood. And then the angels in heaven begin to praise God, saying, righteous art thou, O God, for thou hast given them blood to drink, because they have shed the blood of all the saints and the martyrs. I mean, you know, it is really awesome when you start looking at how God's judgments are so poetic, you know. And so this is a prefigurement of what's going to happen about the Nile. He says in that verse 10, he says, "Then Moses said to the Lord, 'Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in a time past, nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue.'" Now, here again, Moses is giving an excuse. Because if you read in the 7th chapter of Acts, Stephen refers to Moses as a man in great power, both in word and in deed. Okay, now Moses may feel like himself, man, I haven't been in Egypt for 40 years, even though he was born and raised in a palace and he was given the highest education and whatnot. He probably felt to himself, man, I am not the person to go in there and try to persuade Pharaoh, you know, to let your people go, because I don't have the words and I'm not that eloquent as far as being able to explain the situation. But it's really is an excuse. Okay, he really doesn't want to go. So he's making up another excuse. And then it says in verse 11, "And the Lord said to him, 'Who has made the mouth, or who makes him dumb, or deaf, or seeing, or blind? Is it not I, the Lord?'" I think that's phenomenal. You know, in this sense, I mean, it's so obvious in its simplicity, but we're looking around today where, you know, all these people, these so-called intellectuals, these so-called scientists, and these so-called people who are the elite, you know, are trying to tell us that, hey, you know, God didn't form the mouth or the eye or the tongue or the ear or the nose or the feet or anything else. It just all evolved. God's saying, hey, listen, I'm the one that made the mouth. I'm the one that fashioned it. I'm the one that formed it, and I'm going to use it. So he's kind of like trying to cut away Moses' excuses for not going to do his will. Then he, verse 12, says, "Now then go, I will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say." Now, that's really reassuring. I mean, I read this and I think, man, if God's going with me, then hey, man, what else do you need? Because he repeats it twice. I will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say. But he said, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever thou wilt." Now, this is the fifth time. He made a couple excuses in the previous chapter. See, now this is the real, you know, the real thing coming out. In other words, the first five times he was just making excuses. Now that God has undercut all the excuses, he's saying, "Lord, send somebody else. Please send somebody. I just don't want to go." All right? Now God gets angry and he says, in verse 13, but he says, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever thou wilt." And the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. And he said, "Is there not your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently. And moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. And you are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth. And I will be with your mouth and his mouth. And I will teach you what you are to do. Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, and it shall come about that he shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be as a God to him. And you shall take in your hand the staff, which you shall perform the signs." Okay, now, God gets angry with him and says, okay, he says, "All right, I'm going to give you Aaron." And he says, "As a matter of fact, Aaron's on his way down to see you right now." Mm-hmm. Okay, God knows everything. Okay, now, here's a situation where Moses is down in Midian. He's a good 200 miles or more away from Egypt. And God knows that Aaron's on his way down. Now, how did Aaron get away? I mean, did Aaron escape? I mean, what would be the purpose of it? You know, the Bible doesn't give us hardly any details. We just kind of speculate, put a few things together. But if you read a little bit further, we find out that God tells Moses, look, everyone who was seeking your life is dead. So I believe what happened was that when they all died out, Aaron thought, okay, maybe I'll go down and see if Moses wants to come back up to be with his family, because, you know, all those people are dead now. Now, Aaron's 83, so maybe he's not under, you know, the taskmaster. Maybe he has a lowly job, or maybe they feel he's too old to be much of a help to us. Anyway, he was able to get away, slip away from Goshen, from in Egypt, from the taskmasters, and come down, and God knew he was on his way down. But now, see, now Moses, God was choosing Moses to do the job. Moses was so reluctant that God says, okay, I'm going to give you somebody to help you out. You know, your brother Aaron's on his way down. He'll be glad to see you. He says, and I'll use the both of you. But you see, that wasn't God's original intention. It wasn't his original design. And I think If you just look at the situation, you can see there's a spiritual message here. Because Aaron proved to be the weaker one spiritually. Because we know what happened when God finally delivered his people and they went down to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, and God was there, and Moses went up to Mount Sinai, and he was up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and the people thought, well, Moses must be dead, he's dead and gone. So they pressured Aaron into making this golden calf. You know, Aaron makes this golden calf, and then everybody gets out of control, and they're, you know, they're already having this wild party and going and carrying on. And, you know, Moses comes down, and he's so ticked off, he throws his Ten Commandments at that calf, and he just, you know, breaks them and grinds his calf all up, smashes it all up, and then throws it into the creek and has the people get down and lick it up like dogs. I mean, he is just fuming mad. He is so mad. And he looks at Aaron and says, why did you let these people get out of control? And then Aaron, you know, he talked about the lamest excuse you've ever heard. He says, well, I put in the gold and out came this calf, you know. I mean, it was the most lame thing you could ever imagine. But it shows the weakness of Aaron. Aaron was kind of a stumbling block. And Aaron probably wouldn't have done that had Moses obeyed. In other words, Aaron wouldn't have been in a position where people would have pressured him, and he wouldn't have yielded to that. Now, you know, that's speculative on my part, but I'm just simply saying, hey, if God tells us to do something, you know, I think that we really need to be obedient to that rather than saying, well, let George do it or somebody else do it or, you know, this type of thing. I think it's very good that a person feels a sense of their own inadequacy, like Moses did. I think it's very good that they see their own weakness, and I even think it's very good that they have a real reluctance to do it. But then if they don't do it, it's not only disobedience, it's showing a lack of faith, okay? And that's what Moses was doing, and I think that the fact that he basically was forcing God to get somebody else involved here that God really didn't intend to, you know, became a snare right on down the line. Which verse did I leave off on? He said, 18. He said, okay, then Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they will still, if they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. And Moses and the Lord said to Moses, when you go back to the Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Now here's another situation. God says, okay, do all these signs, but I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart so that he doesn't respond to this and he doesn't obey to this. Now, here's another thing that I think causes a lot of people, you know, a lot of theological debates and a lot of consternation and a lot of ink spilled. But as a matter of fact, the Romans, Paul mentions this very thing, the very thing. He's saying, well, if God hardened Pharaoh's heart, well, then how can you blame, you know, Pharaoh for that? But then the Apostle Paul says, well, who are you, O man, to argue with God? But what's interesting, if you count the number of times that God says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, there's 9 different times that God says it. But what's interesting is that 9 other separate times it says that Pharaoh hardened his heart. 9 times God hardened it, 9 times Pharaoh hardened it. But all we need to do is just simply take a look at the way God hardens a person's heart. Okay? In other words, you've heard the old adage, you know, how the sun will melt wax but harden clay. I mean, it all depends upon the substance it's shining upon. And the way God hardened Pharaoh's heart was simply by shining light on it. So it wasn't like God was manipulating him like an uncontrollable puppet or a puppet that had no free will or free choice. God shines his light upon him and it hardens him. He hardens his own heart. This is how God hardens his heart. You know, so God, in a sense, you can't blame God for shining the truth down on top of us. He shines the light of his truth on us. And on some people, it's going to harden them. Other people, it's going to break them. It all depends on what the person's made of, you know? And so you see the situation with Pharaoh. It says that God says, I'm going to harden his heart. But we see how he does it. He does it by, you know, shining his white hot light of truth through his miracles. And then in verse 22, it says, then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I say to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. Okay, we know that this was the last plague that came about. God refers to Israel as his son, as his firstborn. Well, obviously, he wasn't firstborn among the nations, but he's firstborn as far as his inheritance is concerned. Okay, his spiritual inheritance, right? So God says, hey, you can treat my son like this, I'm going to treat your son the same way. So again, you see the poetic justice here. In verse 24, now it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. And she said, you are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me. So he, God, let him, Moses, alone. At the time, she said, you are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. Now, this is only three verses here, but this has caused an awful lot of questions because we're just not giving very much information in regards to what happens here. Again, I think we're kind of groping around in the dark, and the best I can do is try to put pieces together the best that I see them. It's totally speculative on my part, okay? But this is what I see had happened here. Is that Moses has two sons. One of them is Gisharim. Gisharim was his older son. Gisharim means I am a sojourner. And his second son, we find out, is Eleazar, which means God is my help or something of that nature. Okay, so Eleazar was the younger one. It says here that she circumcised one son. So this is what I'm trying to piece this together, and what I can see is this, is that Moses, when his first son was born, Moses had his first son circumcised. And I believe from the context here, now I could be wrong, that his wife Zipporah found that very offensive. And so when his other son came along, Moses neglected to do it. And now they're on their way back to Egypt, but then it says God's standing there and he's going to kill Moses. Now, was God there with a sword, who's going to slay him, or was Moses lying on his back almost dying? How, I don't know. We're not given the information, but whatever transpired there, Zipporah all of a sudden realized that, hey, Moses is going to be struck dead because my youngest son is not circumcised. Mm-hmm. So she takes a flint knife and circumcises him, and then she throws her foreskin at Moses' feet in disgust and saying, you have become a bridegroom of blood to me. Now, what I perceive as what happened here is that, first of all, God's going to kill him because, first and foremost, you know, circumcision was a sign of the covenant. It was a sign of obedience to God. And now here Moses was a man of God who was going to lead God's people, but he wasn't in obedience with what God's will was. So what I'm saying is, when you're in a position of spiritual leadership, hey man, you got no business preaching to anybody else if you're not living it. You know, there's a lot of preachers out there today that basically are saying, hey, don't do what I do, do as I say. You know what I mean? I mean, this is what we've got. We've got this from the White House on down, you know, in the churches today. He was not right with God. Now, in terms of his obedience. Now, here's the thing. What really matters here is the spiritual significance of the circumcision. Okay, the circumcision was merely the cutting away of the excess foreskin upon the male child's penis. Okay, it was a covenant. It was an outward sign of an inward commitment to God. What God was saying was like, you've got to take the knife to the flesh. You've got to cut away all that is impure. Okay, all that is infectious, you've got to cut away. In other words, if we're going to approach God, we've got to do away, cut away everything that's, you know, going to be an offensive to him. That was the sign of the covenant. And Moses didn't fulfill this with his younger son. And the reason I say it only says one son here. So I'm assuming that the older son was circumcised by him. But his wife didn't like the practice, apparently. And because of that, he didn't do it. Well, this causes a problem too. I kind of almost can see the devil here. Because here, a man of God is trying to do the will of God. And then because he's out of God's will in a certain area, then it causes a situation where God's going to, you know, basically take his life. Showing that, hey, Moses, you're not indispensable. Nobody's indispensable. Nobody could be in a situation where they feel like, hey, well, God needs me. Well, God was showing right here that, hey, Moses, you know, I want you, I'm calling you, but I can work my plans around you. You're not indispensable. None of us are, in a sense. What also is transpiring here, I think, is that you see a tension develop between him and his wife. Obviously, there's a real tension. And this very often will happen between, you know, a husband and wife where you got a situation where there's a ministry that's involved. Mm-hmm. That's where the devil attacks a great number of times. When God has a commission for a man or vice versa, it's always very often he could use a spouse to cause, you know, just that much more of a havoc. In verse 27, it says, "Now the Lord said to Aaron, 'Go meet Moses in the wilderness.' So he went and met him at the mountain of God, and he kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord which he had sent him, and all the signs which he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel, and Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he performed the signs in the sight of the people, so that people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction, then he bowed low and worshiped." Okay, in the concluding this chapter, he meets his brother Aaron, and then there's that reunion, and then Moses demonstrates to Aaron the different signs that God has given him, and then they both go on a journey, and they go up to the elders of Israel, and then they demonstrate these signs to the elders of Israel, and then the elders of Israel believe them. Okay, they believe that God has sent Moses and that we're going to be freed here. So the concluding that verse 31, "So the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshiped." So they realized, hey, we're going to be set free real soon. Now, keep something in mind, okay, when we go through this chapter 5. This is a classic example. It's easy reading. It's just it won't take us long to get through it. But it's a classic example of how God's thoughts aren't our thoughts, his ways aren't our ways, and the way we assume that he's going to do something, you know, very often throws us in a state of confusion and a state of, sometimes of total disbelief, because we're assuming that God is going to work something out in a certain way, in a certain time, in a certain manner, and he has his own timing, his own way of doing everything. And even though he's promised he's going to do it, they still have their preconceived ideas. Well, this is the way it should be done. And this is a classic example. When we get to this chapter 5, and this is what I'm talking about here. So does anybody have any questions on chapter 4 before we go on? All right, let's pick up on chapter 5 in the book of Exodus, beginning with verse 1. It says, And afterward Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, 'Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate the feast to me in the wilderness.' But Pharaoh said, 'Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go.'" This is kind of interesting. Okay, Moses and Aaron finally get up to Goshen, and they talk to the elders, and then they go see Pharaoh, and then Pharaoh must have, you know, been almost beside himself, ready to split a gut. "You got to be kidding." He said, "We want to go, you know, worship the Lord." And he says, "Well, who's the Lord?" Okay, Pharaoh, keep in mind, is a type of who?
Antichrist?
It's a type of Satan. That's what Pharaoh represents. I mean, he obviously is proud, he's arrogant, he thinks of himself as being a god, a deity. And he says, "Who's the Lord? I should obey him. Heck with the Lord," you know. And that's what we're dealing with a lot of people today. It's like, who's the Lord that we should obey him, you know? Then he says here in verse 3, he says, "Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a three-day journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, that at least he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." Now, there's no word of God said this to Moses, but read it again. In verse 3, "Then they said," that's Moses and Aaron, "said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." Now, we didn't read where God said that, but I think that Moses had enough spiritual insight to understand at this time that, hey, we need to be obedient to God. This is what God wants, and we're going to do it. Now, remember, Moses had just had this experience where God was about to fall upon him with either pestilence or the sword. He's going to take his life, and his wife saved his hiney, right? So he realized that God is not a God to be trifled with. And I think that is significant, because God is not indifferent towards our worship. Not in the least. The Bible says that the nations that forget God, God is going to turn into hell. I mean, it's a serious thing. And then in verse 4 it says, "But the king of Egypt said to them, 'Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors.' And again, Pharaoh said, 'Look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors?'" In other words, he's saying to them, they'll become a real danger if we don't keep them under our thumb, keep them working.
So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmaster over the people and their foremen, saying, "You are no longer to give the people straw to make brick as previous. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks which they were making previously, you shall impose upon them. You are not to reduce any of it. Because they are lazy, therefore they cry out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Let the labor be heavier on men, and let them work at it, that they may pay no attention to false words." So the taskmasters of the people and their foremen went out and spoke to the people, saying, "Thus says Pharaoh, I am not going to give you any straw. You go and get straw for yourselves wherever you go and can find it, but none of you, your labor will be reduced." So the people scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather the stubble for straw. And the taskmasters pressed them, saying, "Complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you had straw." Moreover, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom the Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, "Why have you not completed your required amount either yesterday or today in making your bricks as previously?" Now, here's what's kind of interesting. It begins to unfold, okay, is that they go to Pharaoh, and Moses obviously is hoping that things will, that Pharaoh will, you know, will heed what Moses has to say. But obviously, you know, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He says, "Hey, you got to be kidding." He says, "With this multitude of people, and you want them to go diddy-bopping out to sacrifice unto your God." He says, "Hey, you know, I'm going to make them work all the harder. They must be lazy good-for-nothings if you got time to come in here and, you know, ask to go worship to God." So he says, "I'm not going to give you any straw to make bricks." Now, of course, back then they would use this mud and they would mix it with this cut straw so that it would heat together, be kind of like an adhesive, that it would, and they would bake it and become construction material. I mean, I guess if they didn't put the straw in there, it would almost be more like a dirt clod. Mm-hmm. But they would make it with straw to give it that firmness. Okay, well, he gives them a command. He's saying, "Okay, you people don't have enough to do. You want to go worship God? You need more work to do." So he sends them out there to gather straw for themselves. And they had to gather up weeds, stubble, whatever they could get to do it. So in other words, they had to work all day. And then apparently they had to go out most of the night to try to gather up more straw. Now, Moses is in a situation where he's observing this. And I'm sure that he's getting very, very concerned. Because how long are they gathering in straw here?
2 days.
2 days. Okay. And then, well, not only that, they had the taskmasters who are Egyptians, but you got the foremen who are Israelites. And the foremen, I guess, were in positions where for years they would be the ones who would tell the people, "Okay, we got to do this, got to do that." And they would answer to the taskmasters, but the foremen, they were kind of like the supervisors, okay? They had it kind of, I don't want to say they had it made, but they were certainly not beaten like the ordinary slaves were. And probably, you know, knowing human nature, probably some of them abused their authority. Probably a lot of these foremen were really despised by the people themselves because they almost seemed like traitors, right? Well, now the pressure is being put on these people to such an extent that even the foremen now are beginning to be beaten because they're not meeting their quota. Now, you look at it and you wonder, well, why is God allowing this to happen? It's going on for 2 days. And if you take a look at it objectively, I think you can see the wisdom in it. That God is allowing this to happen because it's really now where the people are kind of like even out of their houses at night to try to find the straw. They're kind of being weaned from their own homes. Sometimes God has to do this with us in our own spiritual life. When we get too comfortable in the world, when we're too comfortable, let's say, when I say comfortable, when we got our roots sunk too far down into the world, I don't care whether it's in your job or your career or your school or your home or your family or your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your wife, your husband. You know, if all of that is so important to you that it obscures your relationship with God or diminishes it, sometimes God has to wean us from that. And now he's weaning them from their home. And not only that, now the foremen are getting it. So God is kind of like working us out till he's getting the people really to the point where they just want to get out. There's not going to be any of them that want to stick around. So you see God's wisdom in that, allowing it to happen for 2 days. All right, but they can't meet this quota because it's an impossible task. And they weren't to be one brick less than what their quota was. So you can see that, you know, that they were given an impossible job to do. And now the foremen are beginning to cry out. Now the foremen are just, beside themselves. Because read that verse 14 again. It's, moreover, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom the Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not completed your required amount either yesterday or today in making bricks as previously? Then the foremen of the sons of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, saying, why do you deal this way with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants, yet they keep saying to us, make bricks. And behold, your servants are being beaten, but it is the fault of your own people. But he said, you are lazy, very lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice the Lord. So go now and work, for you shall be given no straw, yet you must deliver the quota of bricks. And the foremen of the sons of Israel saw that they were in trouble because they were told, you must not reduce your daily amount of bricks. When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them, and they said to them, may the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us an odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. And Moses returned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why hast thou brought harm on this people? Why didst thou ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he has done harm to this people, and thou hast not delivered thy people at all. Okay, Moses had these expectations, and the people had these expectations, and now everything's gone, quote unquote, in a hell in a handbasket. I mean, they feel, well, where's God in this? And of course, now they're blaming Moses for the situation. And Moses, I'm sure, feels terrible about the situation. All right, you kind of like look at the way, again, that God's thoughts aren't our thoughts. His ways aren't our ways. You would assume that he went in there, big guns, and just done a job. But no, he's working these things out for the ultimate good of the people, his ultimate glory. And in the process, it's hardening Pharaoh's heart, and it's preparing his people's hearts. Okay, even though his people now are becoming resentful, and they're becoming frustrated, and they feel like, well, now, look what you've done. But what does Moses do? It says that he really, begins to seek God in a situation. And I think that's what we need to do when we're in a situation where, we don't have the answers and things. It almost seems like God is contradicting God. And it seems like he's contradicting himself. In other words, God said, "Hey, I want you to go there, and I'm gonna, use you to free my people." But instead of them being freed, what happens? They become just that much more enslaved. So it almost seems as though God contradicted himself, but God didn't. First of all, he told Moses that he was going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and he told them that he was going to make things rougher on him. But the circumstances seem to be contradictory. That's what happens to us a lot of times in our Christian walk. It seems contradictory when God seems to contradict himself. I mean, take a look for example, like what he did to Abraham. He told Abraham, hey, I'm going to give you a son, and through this son, you're going to become a father of a multitude of nations. Your descendants are going to be so numerous, they're going to be like the stars of the sky, they're not going to be able to count them all. And then God says, hey, take your son and sacrifice him to me. Wham! I mean, Abraham's looking at the situation. Well, God, you promised me all this, and now you want me to kill my son. And he was tormented with that for 3 days. He was on that journey to Moriah to sacrifice his son, and he finally figured, well, God must be going to raise Isaac up out of the ashes. That was what he concluded. But that whole time he was struggling with that whole concept that God seemed to be contradicting himself. How could God say one thing and then tell me another? And how could this possibly be? Well, we know what happened because we got the hindsight to look at it. But you put yourself in Abraham's situation. He was really hard-pressed, wasn't he? And sometimes we're in that situation where we feel like, well, God, this is what your word says. This is what you promised. I don't understand why you're not, doing what you promised it. Well, we just have to continue to hold on in faith and know that, hey, God's too good to be unkind. He's too wise to make mistakes. And he's going to work this out in his own time, his own way, his own manner. But it's up to us to just simply trust and obey. And that's what Moses needed to do, is just trust and obey, because God was going to bring it to pass, just like he said he would. But the circumstances seem contradictory at this point. But I think we all go through that. It's given to us for our instruction, that we could take a look at these examples and say, okay, how God may seem to contradict himself in our own life, in our own experiences, but again, we need to hang on to his promises, what he said he was going to do. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?
Yeah,